dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, in our ongoing reading of Charles Eisenstein's 2006 book, The Ascent of Humanity, we finally get to the chapter that addresses the issue of money. Eisenstein is a vocal advocate for the gift economy, which is how I came to learn of him. A listener to this program sent me an article he'd written on that topic. Money and the economic system we have has long seemed to me at the heart of every problem and every social arrangement that I find loathsome. I became starkly aware of this when I was in high school in the 1970s, engaged in my first efforts as an activist on behalf of a citizen initiative to pass the first environmental legislation in California. I was too young to vote or even drive, but as I went door to door to drum up votes from people who were old enough, I repeatedly heard things like, "My husband's union told us to vote against it because it will cost jobs." At this same time in society, African Americans were rising up and burning down the slums they were forced to live in. The difference between a slum and a nice neighborhood is actually all about money. And you can see that very clearly when a process of gentrification takes place. It's actually quite easy to turn a slum into a nice neighborhood, as it involves building materials, equipment, people with the skills and willingness to use them, and a sense of taste. None of these in short supply. The shortage is of a thing called money, an abstraction, a product of the human mind, not an occurrence of nature. We as a species have built our own cages and locked ourselves into them. How this occurred has been the topic of the preceding three chapters, and I want to thank those of you who stuck with it and those of you who have tried their best to do so. I think the book is one of the most interesting, important, and exciting ones that I've ever read. But I ran into a couple of friends who listened to the show who mentioned that they were having difficulty listening to the material. The Ascent of Humanity is a very long book, and I didn't want to drag it out for the better part of a year. I think that now is the time that many people are, for the first time, really seeing that we are living in a matrix, and I mean that in the sense of the science fiction movie of that title, that applies the metaphor of humanity become automatons in a reality that exists only in our minds, and from which we can awaken to freedom. Eisenstein has carefully documented the ways in which we do live in an artificial reality of our own creation, and how this started long ago with our minds, through the changes in the ways we thought about and experienced the natural world and our relationship to it. So now we'll continue with the beginning of Chapter 4, Money and Property. From The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition, by Charles Eisenstein. The Realm of Me and Mine. The idea of property occurs naturally to the discrete and separate self. Just as Cartesian objectivity divides the world into self and other, property divides it into mine and yours. Just as Galilean materialism insists that only the measurable is real, so economics denominates all value in money units. The urge to own arises as a natural response to an alienating ideology that severs felt connections and leaves us alone in the universe. Shorn of connectedness and identity with the matrix of all being, the tiny isolated self that remains has a voracious need to claim as much as possible of that lost beingness for its own. If all the world, all of life and earth, is no longer me, I can at least compensate by making it mine. It has been said of infants, their wants are their needs. The same is actually true of adults too, except that the want has been so distorted that its object can no longer satisfy the need, but may even intensify it. Such is the case with greed. Greed is not some unfortunate appendage to human nature to be controlled or conquered. It arises from a hunger for identity, for the richness of relationship from which identity is built. Ironically, following the pattern of any addiction, indulging in greed only exacerbates the underlying need, because enclosing more of the world into the domain of mine separates us all the more from the connected interbeingness for which we hunger. Perhaps this realization can temper our judgmentality toward the greedy. The next time you witness greed, see a hungry person instead. The next time you feel greedy yourself, take a moment to touch the wantingness, the existential incompletion underneath that greed. The same goes for selfishness generally, that constricted feeling of wanting to manage and control the world outside the self so as to turn it toward the self's benefit. Selfishness in all its forms seeks the benefit and inflation of a self rendered artificially small, a self which is in fact an ideological construct. As that word mine indicates, ownership implies an attachment of things to self. The more we own, the more we are. The constellation of me and mine grows, but no matter how large the discrete and separate self grows, it is still far smaller than the self of the hunter-gatherer. The pre-separation mind is able to affirm, all at once and without contradiction, I am this body, I am this tribe, I am the jungle, I am the world. No matter how much of the jungle we control, we are smaller than the one who knows I am the jungle. No matter how dominant we are socially, we are far less than the one who knows I am my tribe. And far less secure, too, because all of these appendages to our tiny separate selves may be easily sundered from us. We are therefore perpetually and irremediably insecure. We go to great lengths to protect all these accessories of identity, our possessions and money and reputations. And when our house is burglarized, our wallet stolen, or our reputation besmirched, we feel as if our very selves have been violated. Not only does our acquisitiveness arise out of separation, it reinforces it as well. The notion that a forest, a gene, an idea, an image, a song, is a separate thing that admits ownership is quite new. Who are we to own a piece of the world? To separate out a part of the sacred universe and make it mine. Such hubris, once unknown in the world, has had the unfortunate effect of separating out ourselves as well from the matrix of reality, cutting us off in experience, if not in fact, from each other, from nature, and from spirit. By objectifying the world and everything in it, by making an other of the world, we necessarily objectify ourselves as well in relation to that other. The self becomes a lonely and isolated ego, connected to the world pragmatically, but not in essence, afraid of death, and thus closed to life. Such a self, cut off from its true nature and separated from the factitious environment created by its own self-definition, will always be insecure and will always try to exert more and more control over this environment. The extent to which we identify ourselves with our bodies, possessions, and the domain of our control is also the extent to which we are afraid of death. I'm not speaking here of the biological terror that drives any animal to struggle with a predator, but to an ambient dread that drives us to pretense and hiding. More than any other crisis, death is the intruder whose mere approach crumbles the fortress of the separate self. A personal brush with death, or even the passing of a loved one, connects us to a reality beyond the constructs of me and mine. Death opens our hearts. Death reminds us, with a clarity that trumps all logic, that only love is real. And what is love but a melting of the boundaries between self and other? As many poets have understood, love too is a kind of death. To a person identified with tribe, forest, and planet, the death of the body and all it controls is far less frightening. Another way to describe such a person is that he or she is in love with the world. Love is antidote to fear of death, because it expands one's boundaries beyond what can be lost. Conversely, fear of death blocks love by shutting us in and making us small. And fear of death is built into our ideology, the self-definition implicit in objectivist science. Money and property simply enforce this self-definition. They are concrete manifestations of the separate self, the self that is afraid of death and closed to love. Money in its present form is anti-love. But it is not the root of all evil, just another expression of separation, another piece of the puzzle. Other systems of money are possible that have the opposite effect of our present currency, structurally discouraging the accumulation of me and mine. Curious? Keep reading. I'll get to them in Chapter 7. Something like a money system cannot be changed in isolation. Not only does it correspond to our sense of self and our identification with ego, it also flows from the metahistorical process of separation I have described thus far. Incipient already in fire and stone, label and number, the objectification of the world crystallized into a new phase with the advent of agriculture, domestication of plants and animals, the turning of nature to human purposes. Then the machine propelled separation to yet a new level. Its promise of transcending natural limitations set us above and apart from nature, while machine society's mass scale and division of labor unraveled human communities. Finally, the methods and logic of the machine achieved their apotheosis in science, which elevated the long-emerging ideology of the discrete and separate self to the status of sanctified truth. The stage was now set for this ideology to play itself out in the material and social realm. When the world becomes a collection of objects, as in symbolic culture, when these objects are subordinated to human use, as in domestication and agriculture, then they inevitably become property, things that may be bought and sold, defined by their utility for human ends. When science and machine technology then totalize a subjugation of nature, the conversion of the world to money and property tends toward totality as well. The propertization and monetization of life discussed in this chapter grows inevitably from the separation that began with agriculture or before, and that reached its conceptual fulfillment with the Newtonian world machine. Money is the instrument, not the cause, the instrument by which our separation from nature, spirit, love, beauty, justice, peace, and community approaches its maximum. Immersed in the logic of money, we actually see this separation as a good thing. If that seems an outrageous statement, consider what is meant by financial independence and the closely related goal of financial security. Financial security means having enough money not to be dependent on good luck or goodwill. Money promises to insulate us from the whims of nature and the vicissitudes of fate, from the physical and social environment. From this perspective, the quest for financial security is but a projection of the technological program into personal life. Insulation from the whims of the environment, which is to master it, to bring it under control, is the age-old quest of technology. And its fulfillment, perfect control over nature, also means perfect security, the elimination of risk. The campaign to make oneself fully free of the whims of fate, of the vicissitudes of nature, and of reliance on one's community can never actually succeed, just as the technological program can never succeed in its campaign to fully control nature. But the semblance of success may persist for some time. The all-American, upper-middle-class suburbanite with a good job, plus the resume to get another good job if something should happen, good health, plus plenty of insurance should something happen, diversified investments just in case, and the rest. Such a person, in a very real sense, is not dependent on anybody, not on any specific person, that is. Of course he is dependent on the farmer who grows his food, but not on any particular farmer, not on any individual person. The goodwill of any individual person is unnecessary because he can always pay someone else to do it. He thus lives in a world without obligation. He is beholden to no one. Not only is perfect independence, financial or otherwise, forever beyond our grasp, it is an illusion cloaking an even greater dependency. It is not the dependency that is dangerous, though. It is the illusion. It is the illusion that separates us from and thus allows us to destroy so much of what we actually depend on. What does it take to pierce that illusion? Usually it takes a crisis, an encounter with death as described above, or another of life's catastrophes, such as divorce, bankruptcy, illness, humiliation, or imprisonment. We stave these off as long as possible with our programs of management and control, but eventually one or another finds its way into even the most secure fortress of self. These events transform us. We let go as we discover that the only lasting dependable security comes from controlling less, not more, opening up to life, loosening the rigid boundaries of self, letting other people in, and become tied, that is, more dependent, not less, to a community of people and the community of nature. As above, so below. Each of these personal crises has a collective counterpart that humanity is facing today. In our depletion of natural resources, soil, water, energy, we face bankruptcy. In the breakdown of our communities and the rending of the social fabric, we face divorce. In the mounting ecological crisis and the threat of nuclear war, we face death. The conventional response is to try to hold everything together, to maintain the illusion of independence by extending it still further. It is to remedy the failure of control by applying even more control. The importance we place on independence from the social and material world has deep roots in our basic mythology. In the fundamentally indifferent universe of Newton, or the fundamentally competitive world of Darwin, independence from the rest of the world is surely a good thing. By owning more and more of the world, we make it safe, make it ours. We gain mastery over the random forces buffeting us, and we maximize the resources available for our own survival benefit. This chapter explores the ways and means by which money has been the instrument of the destruction of love, truth, beauty, spirit, nature, and community. At the conceptual level, reductionistic science foretold their disappearance several centuries ago. For all exemplify the eliminated Galilean secondary qualities that, when you take it apart, are not there. Money, the unit of account for the reduction of life, has brought reductionism into the daily realm. This chapter tells the story of our impoverishment. My goal is not to make you bitter, however palpable my indignation. My goal, rather, is to raise your expectations and inspire you with a sense of lofty possibilities. By identifying what has been lost and how we may forge a path to its recovery, I am speaking of your sense of disenfranchisement. Whether you are rich or poor, powerful or oppressed, indeed, the disenfranchisement I speak of may be even more extreme in society's winners for two reasons. One is that the impoverishing dynamics of money are often more advanced in their lives. The other is that the vacuity of society's rewards is all the more evident for having acquired them. No longer can the pursuit of them obscure the hunger for the lost wealth of connection and being. I am speaking, in other words, to your sense that a more beautiful world is possible. We need not wallow in grief over the beautiful things that have passed, or wallow in resentment toward the forces that have taken them from us. It is important, however, to acknowledge and to be sad for what is lost, so we may complete the past and create the future in wholeness. Drawing on the Sanskrit root sat, to be sad means to be full. Sad, satisfied, sated, complete. Ready to live and create from a full experience of reality. This chapter will put into a vast context much of what troubles us about the world today. Here are some of the questions that for 10 years or more have inspired the explorations that resulted in this book. I invite you to hold them in your mind as you read this chapter. Why are my adult friendships so superficial? Why are people so busy? Why are children so highly secluded? Why do I see so many fewer children playing outdoors as compared to my childhood? Why do Americans rarely sing in public? What happened to all the great storytellers? What happened to the extended family? Why have houses and yards gotten so huge? Why are prices so distorted that it is cheaper to buy a new appliance than to repair an old one? Why do corporations composed of nice people do awful things? Why don't people know their neighbors very well anymore? Why are there no trespassing signs everywhere? Why are lawsuits and liability concerns so prevalent these days? Why has society become so idealistic? Why are we seemingly helpless to slow down the destruction of the ecosystem? Why is work unpleasant? Does it have to be frustrating and lonely to be a parent taking care of young children? Why do people voice the desire to create community, but then show themselves by their actions to be uninterested? Why are television and video games so addictive? What bothers me so much about copyrights, trademarks, and intellectual property? Why can't people do things for themselves anymore? And I'm reading from Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity. Alone in a crowd. It should not be surprising that money is deeply implicated in the dissolution of community, because anonymity and competition are intrinsic to money as we know it. The anonymity of money is a function of its abstraction. The history of money is the history of the gradual abstraction of value from physical objects. Early forms of money possessed intrinsic value and were distinguished from other objects of intrinsic value by their portability, storability, and universality. Whether camels, bags of grain, or jugs of oil, early media of exchange had an inherent value to nearly every member of the society. As society specialized and trade flourished, more abstract forms of money developed that depended not on inherent value, but on collective belief in their value. Why trade actual bags of grain when you can just trade representations of those bags? Paper money, and to a great extent coinage, depends for its value on collective perceptions rather than practical utility. You can't eat gold. The next stage of the abstraction of value came with the divorce of money from even the representation of physical objects. With the abandonment of the gold standard in the 20th century, a dollar came to be worth a dollar. Currency has become a completely abstract representation of value. Indeed, the abstraction is so complete that it no longer really represents anything at all. The parallel with language is uncanny. Just as words have lost their mooring in the reality of our senses, forcing us into increasingly exaggerated elocutions to communicate at all, so also has money become not just a representation of value, but value itself. The last 30 years have witnessed the final step of this abstraction, the gradual elimination of physical currency altogether in favor of numbers in a computer. Just as words increasingly mean nothing at all, money is also nearing a crisis in which, so disconnected from the utilitarian objects it once represented, it becomes nothing more than hunks of metal, pieces of paper, and bits in a computer. Our efforts to stave off this eventuality of hyperinflation and currency collapse mirror the logic of the technological fix, postponing the day of reckoning. Money is abstract not only with regard to objects of utility, but also with regard to people. Anybody's money is the same. While camels or jugs of oil or any tangible object has an individuality connected with its origin, money is completely generic and thus completely anonymous. Nothing in the digits of your savings account statement tells you who that money came from. One person's money is as good as another's. It is no accident that our society, based increasingly on money, is also increasingly a generic and anonymous society. Money is how the society of the machine enacts the standardization and depersonalization implicit in its mass scale and division of labor. But more than just a means to implement depersonalization, money also pushes it further. To see how, let us return to the paradise of financial independence, ignoring for now that the security it promises is but a temporary illusion, and instead look at the results when it is actually achieved. Often, it is when the semblance of independence is achieved that its emptiness becomes most apparent. Simply observe that the financially independent individual, among other equally independent individuals, has no basis for community except for the effort to be nice and make friends. Underneath even the most well-motivated social gathering is the knowledge we don't really need each other. Contemporary parties, for example, are almost always based on consumption of food, drink, drugs, sports, or other forms of entertainment. We recognize them as frivolous. This sort of fun really doesn't matter, and neither do the friendships based on fun. Does anybody ever become close by partying together? Actually, I don't think that joint consumption is even fun. It only passes the time painlessly by covering up a lack and leaves us feeling all the more empty. The significance of the superficiality of our social leisure becomes apparent when we contrast that sort of fun with a very different activity, play. Unlike joint consumption, play is by nature creative. Joint creativity fosters relationships that are anything but superficial. But when our fun, our entertainment, is itself the object of purchase and is created by distant and anonymous specialists for our consumption, movies, sports, contests, music, then we become consumers and not producers of fun. We are no longer players. Play is the production of fun. Entertainment is the consumption of fun. When the neighbors watch the Super Bowl together, they are consumers. When they organize a game of touch football, alas, the parks are empty these days, they are producers. When they watch music videos together, they consume. When they play in a band, they produce. Only through the latter activity is there the possibility of getting to know each other's strengths and limitations, character and inner resources. In contrast, the typical cocktail party, dinner party, or Super Bowl party affords little opportunity to share much of oneself because there is nothing to do. And have you noticed how any attempt to share oneself in such settings seems contrived, uncomfortable, awkward, inappropriate, or embarrassing? Besides, real intimacy comes not from telling about yourself, your childhood, your relationships, your health problems, etc., but from joint creativity, which brings out your true qualities, invites you to show that aspect of yourself needed for the task at hand. Later, when intimacy has developed, telling about oneself may come naturally, or it may not even be necessary. Have you ever wondered why your childhood friendships were closer, more intimate, more bonded than those of adulthood? At least that's how I remember mine. It wasn't because we had heart-to-heart conversations about our feelings. With our childhood friends, we felt a closeness that probably wasn't communicated in words. We did things together and created things together. From an adult's perspective, our creativity was nothing but games, our play forts and cardboard box houses and pretend tea parties and imaginary sports teams and teddy bear families were not real. As children, though, these activities were very real to us indeed. We were absolutely in earnest and invested no less a degree of emotion in our make-believe than adults do in theirs. Yes, the adult world is make-believe too. Roles and costumes, games and pretenses contribute to a vast story. When we become aware of it, we sense the artificiality of it all and feel, perhaps, like a child playing grown-up. The entire edifice of culture and technology is built on stories, composed of symbols, about how the world is. Usually we don't notice. We think it is all for real. Our stories are mostly unconscious. But the new edifice that will rise from the ruins of the old will be built on very different stories of self and world. And these stories will be consciously told. We will go back to play. As children, the things we did together mattered to us. To us, they were real. We cared about them intensely, and they evoked our full being. In contrast, most of the things we do together as adults for the sake of fun and friendship do not matter. We recognize them as frivolous, unnecessary, and relegate them to our spare time. A child does not relegate play to spare time unless forced to. I remember the long afternoons of childhood when my friends and I would get totally involved in some project or other, which became for that time the most important thing in the universe. We were completely immersed in our project and in our group. Our union was greater than our mere sum as individuals. The whole was greater than the sum of the parts. The friendships that satisfy our need for connection are those that make each person more than themselves. That extra dimension belongs to both partners and to neither, akin to the fifth voice that emerges in a barbershop quartet out of the harmonics of the four. In many of my adult relationships, I feel diminished, not enlarged. I don't feel like I've let go of boundaries to become part of something greater than myself. Instead, I find myself tightly guarding my boundaries and doling out only that little bit of myself that is safe or likable or proper. Others do the same. We are reserved. We are restrained. Our reservedness should not be too surprising, because there is little in our adult friendship that compels us to be together. We can get together and talk. We can get together and eat and talk. We can get together and drink and talk. We can watch a movie or a concert together and be entertained. There are many opportunities for joint consumption, but few for joint creativity, or for doing things together about which we care intensely. At most, we might go sailing or play sports with friends. At least we are working together toward a common purpose, but even so, we recognize it as a game, a pastime. The reason adult friendships seem so superficial is that they are superficial. The reason we can find little to do besides getting together and talking or getting together to be entertained is that our society's specialization has left us with little else to do. Thus, the teenager's constant refrain, "There is nothing to do." He is right. As we move into adulthood, in place of play, we are offered consumption. In place of joint creativity, competition. And in place of playmates, the professional colleague. The feeling we don't really need each other is by no means limited to leisure gatherings. What better description could there be of the loss of community in today's world? We don't really need each other. We don't really need to know the person who grows, ships, and processes our food, makes our clothing, builds our house, creates our music, makes or fixes our car. We don't even need to know the person who takes care of our babies while we are at work. We are dependent on the role, but only incidentally on the person fulfilling that role. Whatever it is, we can just pay someone to do it, or pay someone else to do it, as long as we have money. And how do we get money? By performing some other specialized role, more likely than not, that amounts to other people paying us to do something for them. This is what I call the monetized life, in which nearly all aspects of existence have been either converted to commodities or assigned a financial value. The necessities of life have been given over to specialists, leaving us with nothing meaningful to do outside of our own area of expertise, but to entertain ourselves. Meanwhile, whatever functions of daily living that remain to us are mostly solitary functions. Driving places, buying things, paying bills, cooking convenience foods, doing housework. None of these demand the help of neighbors, relatives, or friends. We wish we were closer to our neighbors. We think of ourselves as friendly people who would gladly help them. But there is little to help them with. In our house boxes, we are self-sufficient. Or rather, we are self-sufficient in relation to the people we know, but dependent as never before on total strangers living thousands of miles away. Times of crisis still can bring us closer to our neighbors. When a health crisis renders us unable to perform the simple functions of daily survival, or a natural disaster or social crisis ruptures the supplies of food, electricity, and transportation that makes us dependent on remote strangers but independent of our neighbors, we are glad to help each other out. Reciprocal relationships quickly form, but usually we don't help out our neighbors very much because there is nothing to help them with. For the typical suburbanite, what is there to do with friends? We can cook together for fun, but we don't need each other's help in producing food. We don't need each other to create shelter or clothing. We don't need each other to care for us when we are sick. All these functions have been given over to paid specialists who are generally strangers. In an age of mass consumption, we don't need each other to produce entertainment. In an age of paid childcare, we hesitate to ask each other to help with the children. In the age of TV and the internet, we don't need each other to tell us the news. In fact, not only is there little to do together, there is equally little to talk about. All that is left is the weather, the lawn, celebrities, and sports. Serious topics are taboo. We can fill up our social gatherings with words, it is true, but we are left feeling empty, sending those words into an aching void that words can never fill. And so we find in our culture a loneliness and hunger for authenticity that may well be unsurpassed in history. We try to build community, not realizing that mere intention is not enough when separation is built into the very social and physical infrastructure of our community. To the extent that this infrastructure is intact in our lives, we will never experience community. Community is incompatible with the modern lifestyle of highly specialized work and complete dependence on other specialists outside that work. It is a mistake to think that we live ultra-specialized lives and somehow add another ingredient called community on top of it all. Again, what is there really to share? Not much that matters. To the extent that we are independent of neighbors and dependent on faceless institutions and distant strangers, we can try. Go meet the neighbors, organize a potluck, a listserv, a party. Such community can never be real, because the groundwork of life is already anonymity and convenience. When we pay professionals to grow our food, prepare our food, create our entertainment, make our clothes, build our houses, clean our houses, treat our illnesses, educate our children, what's left? What's left on which to base a community? Real communities are interdependent. Now we have reached the sinister core of financial independence. It tends to isolate us in a world of strangers. It is strangers whom we pay to perform the functions listed above. It doesn't really matter who grows your food. If they have a problem, you can always pay someone else to do it. This phrase encapsulates much about our modern society. When all functions are standardized and narrowly defined, it does not matter too much who fills them. We can always pay someone else to do it. As an individual, it is hard not to feel dispensable, a cog in a machine. We feel dispensable because, in terms of survival, in terms of all the economic functions of life, we are dispensable. If you buy food from the supermarket deli, the people behind the kitchen doors, whom you've never met, are dispensable. Even if they quit, even if they die, someone else can be hired to fill their role. The same goes for the laborers in Indonesia who make the clothes you buy at the superstore. The same goes for the engineers who design your computer. We rely on their roles, their functions, but as individual humans, they are expendable. Maybe you are a nice, friendly person who actually exchanges friendly greetings with a cashier who's worked for 5 years at the local supermarket. But while you may be dependent on her role, the specific person filling this role is unimportant. It does not really matter if you get along with this person or even know her name. She could be fired or die, and it would make little difference in your life. It would not be much of a loss. Unless you live in a very small town, you probably will never know what happened to her or ever think to ask. All the more so for the vast majority of the people who sustain our material lives. They, unlike cashiers, are utterly faceless to us. Because the economy depends on our roles, but does not care which individuals fill these roles, we suffer an omnipresent anxiety and insecurity born of the fact that the world can get along just fine without us. We are easily replaced. Of course, for our friends and loved ones, people who know us personally, we are irreplaceable. But with the increasingly fine division of labor and mass scale of modern society, these are fewer and fewer. As more and more social functions enter the monetized realm. Thus we live in fear, anxiety, and insecurity, and justifiably so, because we are easily replaceable in the roles we perform to earn money. We can get along fine without you. We'll just pay someone else to do it. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
Well, old Adam Smith, he gave us this myth about how the market will self-regulate. But elite business schemes would still just be dreams without the arms of the state. If you wanna know what they mean when they say we're gonna open up your markets for our free trade, just ask the ghosts of all those who've been killed for refusing to bow down before the dollar bill. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will. Cargill, Monsanto, Merck, or Union Carbide, they go by so many names. But for the land and the people destroyed by their greed, the story is always the same. McDonald's requires McDonnell Douglas. United Fruit needed U.S. Marines. The freedom of their market, supported by fascist regimes. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one. tell us we're free, and we've gotta cut right through their lies. It's not freedom to choose our own destinies, it's freedom to choose our demise. You can die for their money, you can die by their guns. They'll let you choose your own fate. If you get in the way of their profit, you can be sure you'll be burned at the stake. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
They opened fire on the people, and these were true.
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 104
We don't need no great hand coming down from the sky, or your soldiers in olive drab marching on by. To discipline, regulate, liberalize, legislate, we decline. Without you, we were just doing fine. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
Stocks took a fall, reacting to their sector's downbeat corporate news. Investors also are worried about the strength of the economy.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. The Anonymous Power. The monetized life is a lonely life because it reduces the people in our lives to anonymous occupiers of roles, and also because financial transactions are by their nature generally free of obligation. Once the money has been paid and the goods delivered, the transaction is over. No future relationship is implied. Each party has discharged his or her obligation. To be financially secure means to have enough money to discharge all of our obligations, leaving no need to depend on anyone's favors or gifts. It means we are now free of obligations. In other words, we are independent. But another word for obligations is ties. In fact, the word obligate means to place a tie upon someone, ob, on, legate, to tie. The closed money transaction leaves little or no tie between the transactees. Someone enjoying financial security will never have to rely on personal relationships with other people. He won't need anyone to do him any favors. He can pay for your services, thank you. Financial security means that you are not dependent on the goodwill of any individual person. If the farmer who grows your food decides he doesn't like you, no matter, you can pay someone else to grow it. Gift transactions are quite different. They are open-ended and personal. The transaction is incomplete, leaving an obligation, a tie, between the giver and the receiver. Giving a gift creates or affirms a social relationship. It connects the giver and the receiver. Gifts usually imply future gifts, whether reciprocal or to someone else down the line. Moreover, gifts usually don't have a standard value. Their value depends on the unique relationship between giver and receiver, and it reinforces that relationship. In fact, that's one of the main reasons we give gifts in the first place, to become more tied to, and thus less independent of, the person receiving. Money is the opposite. Money is suitable for conducting trade among strangers, such as when any one of us buys something at a supermarket, a Walmart, or online, and it does not make them into anything more than strangers. Money has the same value no matter who gives it to you. It does not imply or necessitate a relationship. In fact, money issues often complicate or destroy relationships. Economics and common sense associate money with self-interest. It should not be surprising, then, that the gift transactions that so sharply contrast with money transactions also generate a different sense of self, as well as different perceptions of what is in the interest of that self. In gift-based societies, the ties created by the gift usually extend beyond two people to involve the whole tribe or village. Lewis Hyde, in his classic The Gift, observes that gifts move in circles, and as these circles spread outward, the sense of self spreads as well to include the entire gift-giving network. Quote, "The ego's firmness has its virtues, but at some point we seek the slow dilation in which the ego enjoys a widening give and take with the world and is finally abandoned in ripeness." Close quote. The contrary process, in which commodity exchange replaces gift-giving networks, corresponds to a narrowing of self into a lonely, alienated ego. When the relationships of gift-giving in a community are replaced by monetary transactions, the fabric of the community unravels. The tight-knit communities of primitive societies were held together by intricate customs of gift-giving. Indeed, the renegade ex-financier Bernard Leiter cites the still surviving gift-giving customs of Japan as the reason why the society has resisted some of the community-destroying effects of the modern economy. Although it is perhaps an unwarranted conclusion to say that communities arise out of gift-giving, and not also the other way around, Leiter's definition of a community is an elegant one. Quote, "A group of people who honor each other's gifts, who can trust that their gifts will be reciprocated someday in some way." Close quote. In the absence of such trust, the interests of the self are the accumulation and control of resources that defines self-interest in a money economy. The gift mentality of hunter-gatherers extended beyond kith and kin to include their entire environment, as did their trust that their needs would be provided. Whether by human or natural agency, the gift circles back to enrich the giver. Thus it was that the hunter-gatherer was uninterested in accumulating property. In the realm of the gift, accumulation is senseless.